a definition for us of the community ministry. Making disciples in the community. And what we mean by that is recruiting and training non-Christians to be disciples of Christ Jesus and make disciples in their environment. That's what the community ministry is. Tony, I don't think we had a prayer before we started, did we? I think we should. Maybe right from where you are, would you mind leading us in prayer, please, and committing our time to the Lord before we go any further? Let's pray, shall we? The community ministry is making disciples in the community, recruiting and training non-Christians to be disciples of Christ Jesus, and then to make disciples in their own environment. Disciple making is the name of the game. And as we think in terms of how will we evaluate the community ministry, it's not going to be how many Bible study groups are held, how many people become Christians, how many conferences do you have, how many of this or that, but rather, are there any disciples and disciple makers coming out of it? But it's going to be done in the community at large, not on a military base, not on a campus, but in the real world. And I say that because I don't feel that the military, those of you in the military, I don't feel that's the real world. It's kind of a parenthesis. It may be if you're a career person, it's your whole world. But you know, a military base is not life as it really is. It's a parenthesis. And really, if you're a university student here, that's not the real world, that university. That life is going to be a little different than what you're experiencing there. Now, what I'm going to do is ask you to complete this questionnaire that is on your chair. If you don't have it, Tony will get one to you. I think you've all got one. Is there anybody who doesn't have one? This gentleman, his wife took his. Now, don't put your name on it, because this question, I want you just to relate or put these things in order of 1 to 7 according to the time that you feel each job would give a Christian time to serve God. It's going to take a little bit of thinking. Let me read each one over and then I'll ask you for questions. Okay, the second one is, I'd like a reason or two why you put 1 and 2 in that order. Third thing is, in what ways could a church or should a church benefit you as a Christian? And I would like several reasons, not just one. It relieves my conscience or something like that. Not just one reason, but give several. Then I'd like you to list there the names of your non-Christian friends. And really, you can put just Bill or Alice if you want to. Again, I'm not going to try to find out who they are and write them a letter. And then I would like to know if there are 3 non-Christians that you feel would count you as their friend. There's a difference, you know, between 4 and 5. And then 6, how will you use your profession to help fulfill the Great Commission? Most of you are going to be going into a job of work. What does that have to do with the Great Commission? Do you have any questions about these 6 questions or comment? Yes. Right. There could be the same person in 4 and 5. Yes. Guidelines for the community ministry. And I hope that in the course of giving you these guidelines, what the community ministry is going to look like, will cover any questions you might have that have been brought up by these questions. And actually, that first one is kind of a dirty trick. That is a, it's not a trick question, but it is one that I hope would stimulate your thinking. But we'll say something about that in a little while. Let me just get an idea. How many of you would be sort of military rather than collegiate? Could I just see your hands or just wave your hands? Okay, and what about the collegiate? How many of you would be collegiate? Well, it's a good mixture. And then, of course, housewives and others, businessmen working already. Okay. What's the Navigator Community Ministry going to look like? The first guideline is that we're going to emphasize the basics because the root produces the fruit. Have you noticed how easy it is for the thing that is of secondary importance to become of prime importance? When we were in London, we had an American friend come to visit us, and as I was showing him around London, and we were driving around, and this is a man who had been on the Navigator staff for a number of years and was then at that time working with a group called International Christian Leadership. And this fellow, Doug, said to me, "Ed, what is your aim in the ministry? Or what is your aim here in London?" I think is how he phrased it. What are you aiming at? And I was just kind of waiting for him to ask that question. And so I took about 10 minutes to tell him about the fact that we were asking God to give us some men who were businessmen or students. And then when God gave us these men, we would, after they'd become Christians, we would help them grow in their Christian lives and then begin to teach them how they could help others, and so that after a while there would be a multiplication of disciples and disciple makers in every strata of life here in this big city. And I thought I had explained it all very well. And when I finished, there was a long silence from the back seat, and Doug said to me, "Whatever happened to know Christ?" You know, every letter that I send out has this little phrase on it, to know Christ and to make him known. And he said, "Whatever happened to that first part?" I thought that was supposed to be your aim. And of course, he caught me out. He really found out that I was beginning to put the thing of secondary importance as of first importance, to know Christ and to make him known. And that's why we say one of the guidelines in the community ministry is going to have to be the same guideline that any of you had in the military or in the collegiate work, that it's the root that produces the fruit. Now, even in the collegiate and the military work, you may forget that from time to time. I think Harvey Oslin referred to this last night in his talk. I did not hear the talk, but I saw the illustration that he handed out, that tree, and the most impressive part to me were those roots. That's the part of the tree you don't see, but that's the part, it seems to me, produces the fruit. What did, and maybe he used this reference, 2 Kings 19, it says that Israel, or the people of God, will again, as a nation, at some point, take root downward and bear fruit upward. And that's just one of the laws of nature, and it's also a spiritual law. That the way to produce fruit upward is not to concentrate on the fruit, but to concentrate on the root. So the basics of the Christian life are going to be important in the community ministry. Not just ministry methods, not just conferences, but really helping people get to know Jesus Christ, to see that their roots go down deeply into Christ. Proverbs 12:12. Does anybody have a King James version of the Bible with them? Would you read Proverbs 12:12, please? There were two. Three. And not just the more mature among us, but this young gentleman here, Bob, has one. Read Proverbs 12:12. Okay, I don't think they heard you. Just a minute. I want to get this on the tape. Hang on.
Speak right into here.
The wicked desireth the net of evil men, but the root of the righteous yieldeth fruit.
Okay, now read that last phrase again. Part
the
B.
Root of the righteous yieldeth fruit.
Yeah. Now, it just so happens it doesn't say that in the Revised. But the principle is right, isn't it? The root of the righteous yields fruit. And that's going to be the basic. That is going to be basic to the community ministry. Helping people in their knowledge and understanding and experience of Jesus Christ. That's where we begin. The second guideline is evangelism is going to be the cutting edge. Now, what I hope to do is give a couple of guidelines and give you a chance to ask questions and argue about these guidelines. I don't think there's any argument about the first one, so we're not going to pause there. But this second one, evangelism is going to be the cutting edge of the community ministry. It's going to be important, and of course that's the cutting edge of the collegiate and the military work, seeing new people come in to our fellowship who are coming to Christ. But I want to say this, that in the community ministry we're probably going to have a little different, we're going to have a little different approach to evangelism. That's why I asked question 4 and 5. It seems to me that when you're working with people in your own environment, friendship is going to be a key to evangelism. I read an article by a missionary statesman, and in it he said, we have very high qualifications for a person who puts himself forward for missionary service. We ask that they have a high level of education. We ask that they have a high character, a very well disciplined Christian life. We ask that they be able to get along with people. And he named a number of the qualifications for a person who's going to do missionary service. He said, I would like to see us add one qualification. He said, I would like to have every missionary candidate, as well as these other qualifications, be asked to sit down and make a list with names and addresses that we could check up on of 10 of his non-Christian friends. You know, that's quite staggering. I wish they'd start doing that. I was a missionary. And, you know, when we got off the airplane in Nairobi, Kenya, East Africa, and we walked down, they don't call it the gangplank, but whatever they call that thing you get out of the airplane on. You know, the African fellows weren't standing at the bottom there saying, tell us about Jesus. And when we got our luggage to our house, and we moved in and we set up housekeeping, African people weren't trotting down the road to knock on our door and say, welcome, O navigator, tell us about Jesus. We had to start in Africa the same way we started in Minneapolis. You have to make friends. And a plane ride doesn't make you a missionary. And if you can't make friends in Minneapolis with non-Christians, I don't think you're going to be able to make friends. In fact, it's going to be harder. Because not only were they not at the airplane asking us to tell them about Jesus, they were very... just lethargic. They didn't, you know, nobody was interested when we went to them. And so we had to make friends. They were, in fact, rather antagonistic. Then this missionary statesman said we shouldn't stop there. We should then ask these missionary candidates to list 10 non-Christians who will look to them, look at them as their friends, because that's the real test. It is not whether you think that Bill is your friend, but does Bill look on you as his friend? And you know, if a missionary doesn't have that ability, then he might as well stay home. Because he's got to know how to make relationships with non-Christians. Now, I think that in our work on the military base and on the campus, we've trained people in a particular approach to evangelism that is helpful. But I think we've got to begin developing in this other area of friendship. I think we've trained people to knock on doors, to take a survey, and we've found the people who are interested. But I think there is another area of evangelism, and this whole area of friendship that we need to help. And you need to begin to learn, if you are going to graduate, or you're going to leave the military, and the only type of evangelism you know how to do is knocking on a door and taking a survey, then I think you need to begin preparing yourself for the real world when that doesn't really work. I had an illustration of this. I went to Iowa and spent a weekend with Bud View and about 30 of the men that he's working with. All of them are now working people, businessmen, farmers, and they're really keen disciples. Five of these men had come to Christ and been trained in the context of a work in a college there in that area. And as they grew in their Christian lives, they became very fruitful. They were men who had experience in leading people to Christ, in following up new Christians, and they had really seen God work through their lives. We were at this conference together because now they'd been out of university for about 3 to 4 years, I forget exactly how long, and they were part of Bud View's team. But they came to me, these 4 or 5 men, and they said, "Ed, we're frustrated. We've been out of the university ministry now for 3 or 4 years. God used us during those years in university. But since we've been in the working world, we're frustrated. We haven't been able to be fruitful in the same way we were in the university. What's wrong with us?" So I said, "Well, I mean, tell me about it. What, you know, maybe there aren't any non-Christians around where you work." "Oh, yes. That, when I first came to my office, this one man worked in an engineer's office. There were 5 other men in this office, and he said, my first week there, I shared the bridge with these 5 men, and they weren't interested. So I've been working with these same men for 3 years now, and none of them have come to Christ, and I'm just totally frustrated because I can't figure out what I can do to witness. And there's no big program of going out door to door or anything here with Bud View and the businessmen, so I can't figure out why I'm not fruitful." And you see what they've done? They'd used the same approach they'd learned with university students while they were students with these 4 or 5 businessmen in their office, and it didn't work, and so they'd shown the whole thing, and they hadn't bothered to take the time to build a relationship and make friends with these men before they started sharing the gospel with them. And what one fellow said to me, and he saw it as he even explained it to me, he said, "I know what it is. While we were in university, we'd knock on a guy's door and we want to share the gospel with him. If he wasn't interested, there were always 400 other doors we could go knock on. And we were bound to find someone who didn't have anything else to do, and we could talk to him." Well, he says, "I've been working with those same 5 guys now for 3 years. They weren't interested when I first, and that just blew the whole thing. And I think this whole matter of building relationships and friendships is something we've got to teach ourselves. If nobody will train us, then we've got to realize that while door-to-door evangelism and what we call cold turkey is helpful, it's not the end. Don't stop there. There's another whole area of evangelism, making friends." You know, there's a verse in the Bible that I used to sort of skirt around in my mind because I personally am one that really gets excited, although it's hard, about taking a group of fellows out and knocking on doors in a dormitory or in a neighborhood to teach these fellows about witnessing. But there was this verse in 1 Peter 3:15 that I always kind of had a problem with, because it says, "Put Christ first in your lives and be ready always to give an answer to every man who asks you a reason of the hope that's in you with meekness and fear." Because that verse said, don't go out and knock on doors. Don't go and preach the gospel. Just be ready in case people ask you. And I thought, boy, that's chicken. We're not going to train any disciples that way. Well, now it's true that there is a need to help people break the sound barrier, that taking a group of fellows out witnessing is really going to help them trust God. It's going to help them begin to speak about Christ. But the trouble is, I think it ends there with many of us. 1 Peter 3:15, I think, gives us the key for evangelism in the real world. And you can't explain it away. Peter does not say, go out and harangue people. He says, you put Christ first in your life and then wait until people. Be ready, be prepared, not wait. That's the wrong choice of words. Be ready. I think there's active preparation. Be ready to give an answer to every man who asks you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. I think that's the key for evangelism when you leave your present sphere. Do you know how to do it? Have you experienced that? If you haven't, now's a good time to begin. While you're in your last year at university or while you're in your last year of service in the military, you've had experience in this other type of witness, begin to develop this other way. If those guys in Iowa had only learned how to do this, I'm sure they wouldn't have had 3 or 4 frustrating years. Now, what's interesting to me is that Peter, when he writes to these people, says, be ready to give an answer for the reason of the hope that's in you. Do you know anything about hope? I find very few Christians know very much about hope. And what Peter says here is, don't be ready to explain the bridge. Don't be ready to explain the gospel. And you're all great at that. Boy, at the drop of a hat, you can make it clear. And I think that's important. But the thing that Peter says here that's going to attract people to ask questions is your hope. And I find the reason people aren't asking Christians questions is because they don't know anything about hope. They know about faith. They know about claiming promises. But they don't know anything about hope. So you need now to begin polishing up your hope so it kind of is reflective. And because that's what's attractive to the Christian. That's what's attractive about the Christian to the non-Christian. It's your hope. Love is the apologetic, says Schaeffer. It's the final apologetic of the Christian life. Love amongst Christians is what proves that you are a disciple. But it isn't what causes people to ask questions. It's hope. So evangelism is going to be the cutting edge, but it's going to have to be an evangelism based on friendship and being part of their world so that they can see your hope. If you're only there knocking on the door or in and out, they're not going to see your hope and ask about it. Okay? Those are, well, the first two guidelines. Do you have any questions? Any arguments? Anything you'd like to underline of what I've said or you'd like clarified? Yeah?
Yeah, I'd like to clarify the idea. Okay, in a collegiate ministry, the idea of friendship evangelism comes across, and one of the things that they always stress is make sure that people equate you with Christ from the very beginning. And then go ahead. Now, do you agree with this in this sense? Should we make it? You brought up the illustration that these guys had shared the bridge with all these guys, and that had blown it for them. Well, That's what brought up this question about making an open question of Christ. Like, just keep quiet and just go on and not make a claim and wait till the friendship is developed and then say something? Or should I say something first and then?
The question is, and I'm repeating it now for the tape, okay? The question is, should we identify ourselves with Christ early on? And this was related to the question about the fellow sharing the bridge the first week he worked with these men, and kind of that blew it for the rest of the time. Or should we just be quiet and not say anything until they ask? Well, I would have, maybe somebody else would have an answer on this, because that's a good question. Yes.
Well, right off, if you're going to be in a situation like that in an office, they're going to see that you're different by the fact that you're not going to be swearing or telling coarse jokes or acting like the type of guy. So I think there they'll probably see that hope in you. Christ, there's something different about your life. So I think that's.
Yes, the answer to the question is that they would see something different in your life rather than, so that your identification with Christ is, in that case, the way you live, not just what you say. Anything else? Yes.
At the same time, if we wait for a long period of time before we share Christ with a person, we might give them the idea that we don't think it's very important.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how would you answer that? I mean, how long do you wait?
3.5 months.
Can't say, can you? Yes. And here the suggestion is that if you really love the person and go out of your way, not just because they have a soul and you're going to get their scalp, but rather because you like them as a person and you're willing to give yourself to them, they cannot resist asking or at least wondering what makes you tick. They may be too shy to ask or they may not know, but at some point they will. That's right.
As you would expect. Mm-hmm. But they're going to ask just by a comment, mm-hmm. they're going to ask for help, it's going
right.
to come through if you're listening.
So the idea is to be sensitive and not to wait until they say, why is it that you have hope? But anything that would indicate that they have got the hook in them. Yes. Yes, and I think so what this lady is saying is that there are ways of identifying with Christ without sharing the whole gospel, in just your comments, your dependence upon God. And you know, I wish we could say more about hope, because that is a very key thing in the Christian life, and I find very few of us really know what it's, so I'm not going to say that now. Pardon? No, I don't think I will. That'd be too easy. I won't give any comments on hope right now. I'll just kind of leave that with you. I wish we could have a workshop on hope. But since we haven't, and it's only one point, a very important point, I'd like to leave that with you. Yes?
One danger is to not to say anything and then get caught in the trap of compromising, of being caught in a situation where they try to find out what they believe and back off and use it for a cover, an escape. Rather than just waiting for an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Now, what does the verse say? In other words, what this gentleman is saying, there is a danger of waiting and then compromising and backing off and using the fact that you are waiting as an excuse for not capitalizing on the opportunity when it comes. What does the verse actually say that I quoted? It doesn't, and I think I caught myself in this. It says, be ready. Always. It doesn't say wait. It says be ready. Always. And I feel that that's, in a sense, it's waiting, but that's not the emphasis of the verse. It's to be ready to give an answer to any person who asks you a reason of the hope that is in you. Now, it's interesting to me how little is said to the average Christians in the New Testament about preaching the gospel. And how much is said about just being ready to give an answer? What about 1 Corinthians 15:34? Awake to righteousness and sin not, for some have not the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. There are a lot of people who don't know about the gospel, therefore get out and knock on doors and preach the gospel. It doesn't say that. Now, so it's interesting that here's Paul, and when he writes to the Christians at Corinth, he doesn't say there are a lot of people who don't know about the gospel, and I speak this to your shame, because you're not out, boy, on Tuesday nights. He says, awake to righteousness and sin not, because some had not the knowledge of God. 1 Corinthians 15:34. Yeah. Sorry, Vern. Can I just repeat this for the tape? The point has been made that in a military situation where a man, a new load of people come in, that there are those who feel, well, I've got to really make a stand for Christ, and so they're kind of the fire-eating, brimstone-breathing type, and they condemn things, and they let it be known that they're real Christians, and that this does not have the effect of causing people to want to know what it is that makes them tick. It rather puts people off. And what you're saying is that there is, that hope itself is a secure thing, and that sometimes these other people give you the impression of being rather insecure. And I think we do have a problem as Christians. We're a little afraid to really mix it up. Okay, so now we may not have too much time more on this, but Vern, any point?
Well, let me just underline on that hope and experience that I had out on the job one day. This fellow raising a family expressed that he was really fearful because his children were coming up in an environment where it looked like the world was falling apart and everything. He expressed no hope, basically. And so I said, well, I put my hope in Jesus Christ. Said a few more words than that, and he said, you know, that sounds good to me. And he came to Christ, the whole family just changed. And that's just a thing, being ready with that hope. You have a hope that is just fantastic above what this world is facing. And really, really understand it.
And I'll tell you, I don't have too, you know, I look at the government, and I don't have much confidence that man's really in charge. Man doesn't really, economically, do you think they really know what they're doing? Huh. Okay, can we leave evangelism now? I think we've the point is that evangelism is going to be the cutting edge of the community ministry. It's not how it's our people coming from death to life where you are. And it's probably not going to be as programmed as what you've been experiencing in the military. But it's going to be more as you live and you're involved with non-Christians, and you're going to have to get involved with them. Tony?
It's wonderful. It's always bound to be slow. I think it's the frustration that people feel. It's always going to get slow.
Question is, is it always going to be slow? Let's say this, Tony. I mean, I'll just answer that. Maybe others would... have a point, or maybe you have something in mind. So let me comment, and then I'd appreciate your comment. I think it will always take time. Slow sounds bad, but I don't think time is bad. I don't think growth is bad. A relationship takes time, and I feel that time is good. In fact, in Brazil, Jim Peterson tells the story, and I met the fellow and heard it from his own lips, about Mario, who was a Marxist. And Jim
was just his friend for, I think, a year before the guy even asked any questions. And he then asked questions, and Jim said, would you like to study the Bible with me to find the answers? I promise not to preach. And the man said, yes, in fact, you know, you don't even use God because he's X. I don't believe in God. And if Jim used God, the man would fly into a rage. And you could talk about Jesus because he was an historical person, but don't talk about X because I just don't want to hear about him. And so they did Bible study for, I'm not quite sure of the time, but I think it was 2 years. And Mario became a Christian. In fact, many of the men in Brazil who have become Christians over a period of 6 months to a year to 2 years of Bible study. And you know what? No backsliders. Now, to me, that's a good illustration of the fact that, you know, time is not necessarily wrong. And in fact, I would rather have a fellow take a year to become a Christian and understand it than to respond to an emotional appeal and forget it and not grasp it. And if you read the sermon, the parable in Matthew 13 of the different types of soil, do you remember what the different types of soil are? There's the seed that was sown along the path. There's the seed that was sown on shallow soil with just a little bit of soil and then rock underneath. And then there was that seed which was sown amongst weeds. And it says the difference between those three and that final one which bore fruit was that the final one that bore fruit heard and understood. The first three only heard. In fact, it says the one that was shallow, it heard and did not understand. So understanding is important in evangelism. So I would rather take a year to build a relationship with a man and then another year to 2 years to do Bible study with him because he understands. And so much of our evangelism that I see, you get this quick decision. The guy who makes a quick decision can also make a quick non-decision. I don't mean that he gets unsaved if he was saved, but I think that it is possible for a person to be emotionally moved and not be saved. Just like the seed that was planted on this soil with only this much depth. And I think that's a picture of a person who just doesn't understand the gospel. Can we leave this one now? I'm sorry, we'll skate right over it now because I do want to cover these other guidelines, and I think we just need to do some thinking about this whole thing. And Tony, do you have a comment on this matter of slowness and time that you would like to give? Because you may have had something in mind when you asked that. No?
I think the cultural pressure of numbers and the Western cultures, the numbers and time oriented. And you get involved in a ministry where six guys come in a month. You go somewhere else where maybe not one comes a year, you feel kind of figured.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So the idea is that, what is the answer to that, Tony? I mean, is it similar to what I've said, or can you give anything else that you feel would be an answer to this problem of if you are in a ministry where six men came to the Lord in a month, and then you go somewhere else and maybe, you know, one person in a year? And the point there is that the Bible nowhere talks about making converts, but being a witness. And this is how this gentleman has resolved that. Can I just press on now? The third guideline is this. The community ministry will help graduates and ex-military people to continue the vision of disciple-making. That's one thing we want to see happening as a result of this community ministry, that when you leave the university and you haven't become a Navigator staff member going back to work in another campus somewhere, or you leave the military and you're not going back to work on a base that you continue the vision of disciple making. I figured it out, and there are 200 people graduating from the universities of this country this year who are disciple makers. 200. There may be more, but conservatively, there are 200 who are qualified as disciple makers who are graduating, leaving university. Now, about 10 of those, I think, the navigators will tap and say, would you join the navigator staff and go and work on a campus somewhere else? And they'll say yes. That leaves 190. About another 20 will be asked, now, would you mind, please, getting a job in Lansing, Michigan, and helping the fellows there who are working with students to reach other students? And the guys will say, yes. So that's another 20. That leaves 170, if I figure things right. What about them? Do you realize the impact that 170 people who are disciple makers can make in this country? But what happens? They go out. They go into an office. They try to share the gospel the first week that they're there with the five men in their office. It doesn't work. The guys don't respond. They get frustrated. They think there must be something wrong with me, or if they don't realize there's something wrong with them, they think there may be something wrong with the vision, and they lose heart, and they stop. What I feel we need to do in the community ministry is continue to stimulate and encourage you people who've been part of a ministry. You have learned some valuable lessons to overcome those first discouragements so that you continue the vision, because it does work. You can make a difference in this world by training another person or another couple in Christian discipleship. And you can do it. It's going to be done differently than you did it in the university. You're not going to have the blessing of having 15 or 20 other guys around who all agree and feel the same way. But it can be done. It's going to be different, but it can be done. Fourth guideline. We want to help men right where they are. Oh, no, that's not the point. Sorry. We want to help you set your own objectives and reach them. We want to help you set your own objectives and reach them. This is the fourth guideline. So what is it that you feel God is asking you to do in terms of sharing the gospel? Well, we want to help you set the objectives that you feel you should reach right there in your environment. And the reason I say this is you can't do it on your own. There are very few men who can continue the vision of disciple making on their own. If I didn't have someone over my shoulder kind of saying every once in a while, hey, Ed, where's your man? Who are you spending time with? Who are you praying for? I don't think I would carry on. It's just a fact of life. I don't think my dedication is less than yours, but I feel it's just a fact of life that I need others to continue this vision. So we want to help you, not by telling you what to do. See, in London, we had a graduates conference for all the guys who were graduating the next June. And what they came to us and said was, what do we do? They wanted us to kind of set their objectives, tell them what to do, pat them on the head, and go do it. But we can't do that with 200 graduates around the country. What we've got to do is begin helping you set your own objectives in terms of disciple making, and then help you reach them, because you can't do it on your own. But the name of the game is disciple making. After we've helped you set your objectives, and I come around and see you a year later, or some navigator, what he's going to ask you is not how many Bible study groups did you have, how many conferences did you run, how many youth groups have you met, but he's going to say, where are they? Show me. I want to see these disciples. That's what I'm looking for. Disciple making is the name of the game. That's why the community ministry, the operative word is variety. You're going to have many different approaches to making disciples, but the product is the same. I'm going to want to see disciples. And I know that's what you want to see. So I want to try to help you. And the local navigator community ministry worker wants to try to help you set some objectives.
but it's going to be in terms of disciples and disciple makers. And then the fifth guideline, we want to emphasize your sphere of influence, not ours. What we're going to emphasize is not, now you come and help me reach the people in my neighborhood for Christ and make disciples of them. No. I want to help you reach the people in your neighborhood or at your job. In other words, the community ministry is going to be carried on where you are. Now, there may be some exceptions to that, but by and large, it's going to be where you're working, where you're living. Whereas in the military and in the collegiate, we navigators get you guys and girls involved in what we're doing for your training and your development. But what we're going to do in the community ministry is try to help you reach that sphere where you are. Now, I want to say something in this context about your job. And this is, of course, that first question, where, as I say, it is a bit of a trick question. In fact, it's a dirty trick question. But because I wasn't going to ask you to put your names, I felt it was okay. I just wanted to know what you're thinking about relative to your job that you're going to get. What's your attitude toward that job? I know Christians who feel that that 8 hours a day is what's hindering them from serving the Lord. That's rubbish. That is service to God. Now, do you realize the implications of that? That's not just when you graduate, but I think the implication is that your studies are serving. You're not serving God when you're leading a Bible study group, when you're knocking on doors only, but when you're hitting the books, you're serving God. You guys in the military, when you're servicing a jet, when you're doing KP, whatever they do in the military these days, whatever your job is, that is service for God. It isn't just when you come to Disneyland for this conference. It's your job. Now let me share with you Colossians 3, verses 22 to 24, because I feel, was there anyone last night in the couples meeting? In the couples meeting? Good, okay, because I did share this last night. I hate to repeat myself. You know, I think this is the most gracious, one of the most gracious passages in the Bible. Because, can you imagine what it was like to be a slave in the first century? Nothing, you were not your own. You were the complete property of your master. And if you poured too much hot water into his bath, he could cut your arm off. He could sell you. He could kill you. There was no protection for a slave. He could sell your children. Your children were not even your own. Your wife was not even your own. You could be separated and sold. You were just a thing. That's all you were. Just a thing. The master could crush it. He could throw it out. He could do anything he wanted to with it. So a slave in the first century hears about God's love. He hears about heaven. He hears about Jesus, God in the flesh, dying on the cross for man's sin, and rising from the dead. And it sounds terrific. And he hears about it from a person who saw Jesus rise from the dead. And he said, it's true. And he commits himself to Jesus. And Jesus Christ comes into his life in the Holy Spirit and makes him a new person. Gives him something to live for, a hope, instead of hopelessness. And what's his reaction? Now I want to serve him. I want to give myself to him. I want to be available. And he sits down and he considers his position and what sets in. I'm sure frustration. Because what does he have to give to the Lord? He doesn't have weekends free and available for conferences. He doesn't have evenings free for Bible study groups. In fact, if he's caught any time away from his job, from his work, he can be punished, killed, anything. So he gets disappointed, doesn't he? Frustrated, completely discouraged. Here I am, God has done so much for me and I want to serve him and I can't. So he finally gets away one Sunday and he meets with a group of Christians and he's probably sitting there worrying about whether his master is going to miss him. And here he is serving this master, but he's in church or in with a group of Christians and they've gotten a letter from Paul and it's written to the whole church at Colossae and it says some terrific things about Jesus and it really is helpful and wonderful, but he's kind of wrestling with this whole idea of How can I serve God? And my master is so unjust and ungodly. And the reader, or whoever is reading this letter publicly, comes to this part. And he pricks up his ears because it says, slaves. And he pricks up his ears. And this is what Paul writes to these people. Slaves, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever your task, work heartily as serving the Lord, and not men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. Now, isn't that gracious? Just think that, guys. You mean when I'm scrubbing the floor for my master, who is a penny-pinching, cruel, unjust, demanding, rotten pagan? Do you mean when I'm scrubbing that floor, I am serving you? That's right. Now, can you imagine what that did for those guys? Now, if a slave is serving Christ by serving a master like that, what about your service for the government? For your sergeant, for your lieutenant. You see, where I first began to think of this was my wife. I'm out serving God, preaching at conferences, leading Bible study groups, leading men to Christ. What about her? Looking after the children, washing my clothes. That's service for Christ too. What about your attitude toward your job? You know, and this relates back to evangelism, actually. You know that the gospel spread fastest amongst the slaves than any other group in the first century. It was the slave who turned to Jesus by their hundreds and thousands. Of course, they had the most needs. They had the greatest need for a hope, something to look forward to. But it spread like wildfire. Why do you think it did? I don't think it was just because of the way they preached, but I think it was the way they lived. They got their minds right, they got their hearts right, and their attitudes right toward their masters and their jobs, and they served Christ joyfully, washing that floor or pouring that water or digging that ditch, no matter how menial it was. And other people noticed it, I'm sure. The slaves noticed it, and the gospel spread. You know what you also learn from the first century? That dozens and dozens of slave owners, masters, landlords, became Christians. Why? Not because and the slaves were the only ones that had contact with the gospel. Their own slaves. Why did they become Christians? Not because the slaves explained the gospel to them. That isn't what interested them. It was the fact of the way they served their masters. And the gospel spread also in that strata of society. And I feel that here we may have the key to evangelism. Not only our hope, but the way we serve and live and do our work. So I think the community ministry is going to emphasize where they are. Not I don't think it is, but it will. Your ministry of evangelism is going to be where you are. And where you are is where you work. Now, any comments, questions, or arguments about these points, about helping the graduates, helping people set their own objectives, and emphasizing their sphere of influence? Yes, sir.
I have a problem putting myself outside of a man of ministry into a local church just on my own, kind of, and trying to get the job done and making disciple makers. People in there just don't have that vision. And is it possible to do it outside of people that really have the same vision?
The question is, can you do this in the context of a local church where the people do not have the same vision that you have? Any comments on that? There are some churches that are doing it. Would you suggest that he change churches?
No.
No, I wouldn't either. Well, let me say this. I feel, first of all, that the place for the ministry to go on is amongst non-Christians, not Christians. And I feel that sometimes we think that we are ministering and we're just kind of proselytizing in the church. Now, I feel it's right to work in the church, and I feel that we can have a ministry to the church. But I feel that we need to think in terms of, even if we are ministering in the church, that the aim is to help those Christians reach non-Christians. Now, I do have something to say about the church, so maybe I'd like to just hang on until my next point, which happens to be dealing with that situation, okay? Yes?
I think you waited until just the past few years to make this community ministry push with the emphasis on the more, you hear a lot more about it.
Right.
How so long?
Well, I think that and the question is, why have the navigators waited so long to make this emphasis on the community ministry prominent? Because it does seem that it has been in the last 3 years. I believe up until 1960, you would call our work very community ministry oriented. At that time, because we were getting requests for navigator men in various Christian works, various areas, and Lauren Sanney realized that we were giving away most of our men and we were not raising up men in the meantime, and so he felt that in the 60s we had to concentrate on the raising up of navigator staff members. And the place to do this was on the university campus and in the military. And so we have been emphasizing that, particularly this last 10 to 12 years. And frankly, we're getting to the place where every campus is going to be manned with a navigator. So you've got to think, well, what are we doing on these campuses? Are we just raising up navigators to raise up navigators to raise up navigators? If we are, that's rather limited, and it doesn't help us fulfill the Great Commission. We could raise up 20,000 navigator staff members. We only have 200 in the world, full-time area representatives, plus another 800 you would include, which would be office workers and contact points and people in various stages. We could have 15 or 20,000 navigators who are raising up navigators, and we would never help fulfill the Great Commission. So we've realized that along with raising up navigator staff members to help man or staff the movement, we need to be also emphasizing that when a person becomes a navigator, he's not just supposed to raise up other navigators, but he's supposed to build disciples who relate to the community. So I think it's kind of been a something that we did when Doss worked with men in the Navy, and then later on with the Billy Graham team, the emphasis very much was anyone can become a disciple or a disciple maker. That would have been from about 1937 until 1960. And then in 60 we decided just to go into this more concentrated ministry because of the demands that were being made on the organization. Now I think we're saying, well, we know we can do that, and we're going to continue doing that, but now we want to make sure that the people who are being raised up and trained in disciple-making continue that vision when they don't become navigators but become part of the real world. Does that answer that question? You may not, I mean, that may not be a good enough reason, but that, I think, is how it actually happened. Okay, anything further? Yes, sir.
I have a story where I am, but the ministry is very college-centered, yet I'm a school teacher, and I want to keep in contact with the man because, as you stated earlier, you need this, and I need the help and assurance. But yet my own ministry is with the school teachers and people that work there, and I'm not sure in my own mind at this point how to resolve it.
The question is, how can a school teacher, for instance, maintain contact with a navigator work where he can get encouragement and stimulus and further training when the local navigator work is quite collegiate oriented, and so the local man might not have the time or the inclination to help someone who is not working with college students. Well, I think just be patient. Later on I want to give you a map which indicates that there are men doing community ministry solely who are navigator staff members in 15 cities. And so one would hope that as we go on there would be more and more men, say within a couple of hundred miles, who could just help you with a bit of encouragement and a bit of stimulus. You probably wouldn't need the same supervision and direction that someone would need who is in a collegiate work. And we do hope to broaden the network of men who are concentrating on the community ministry. Right now in the United States we only have 15 who are full-time in this. So I would say be patient and then just try to get to things like this every time you can. Yes, sorry. Sorry, you've had one. I'll just add this gentleman first, please.
When you say community ministry, that's not the church.
Beg your pardon. It does include the church, I would say. Yes. That which is navigator, disciple-making in your own environment, and that includes the church. Yes.
If the community ministry isn't couple-oriented, what is the ex-service men and college students get in?
If it isn't couples-oriented, where does the ex-military man fit in?
Single ex-military or college.
You mean if it is couple-oriented?
If it is not. It seems like it's more couple-oriented to me. Because, a couple getting in the community and the church and family, mm-hmm. and it just seems like it's a couple-oriented. Where does the single guy fit in?
Well, I think that he's part of the community. Where he works, where he lives, where he worships, and the fact that he's a single man, I don't think is the issue. It's does he wish to be continuing the vision of disciple making when he leaves the military or the college? And there are several areas. I'm going to hand out this list that has the addresses of places where we are working, and there are a couple of places where they are. They do have groups of single men. I think Bill Greenaway has that. I think I can't think of the others right just offhand, but it is on the list. Now, in London, we had the privilege of working with some fellows. They were involved in the Navigator Collegiate work. They left, they got jobs, and we encouraged them and kept in touch with them and worked with them through these weeks and months, when they realized, well, what worked in the collegiate does not seem to work, the methods. So we had to work with them through those first months when they were tempted to throw out the principle with the method. They kind of maybe didn't have clear in their mind what was method and what was principle. So we keep saying, well, the principle is find a man and build him up. The method may be knocking on doors. Well, that may not work. There may be therefore another method to develop. And one of these fellows was Bernie. He lived with us for a year. He got a job in London and began going down to the local YMCA and made some friends, began doing Bible study, and after the first year, I guess, he did Bible study with the first group of fellows for about a year, and six of them became Christians during that year. And now there are 30, and they're meeting in Bible study, and they're reaching out, and they're praying for all the YMCAs in London. So it seems to me, wherever you are, that's where the community ministry should go on, whether you're single or married. Okay, can we go on? Because I thought we would have more questions about your jobs. But I hope if you get your thinking right on that job, imagine what it'd be like serving God 10 hours a day. And not just on weekends. Not just in leading Bible study groups. I don't think you can say that one is more service for God than the other. They're both equally service for our Creator. And you get that right, and people are going to be asking you about it. It's going to be related to the local church. That's another guideline. The community ministry will be related to the local church. And I say this, you see, I wonder what you put down here. What could the church do for you? The reason I say that, now most people, when I say that, they say, yeah, that's right, we've got to maintain good public relations with the church. Good PR. Well, that's not why I put it down here. I put it down here because you need that church. And when I say the church, maybe I just mean a group of other Christians. In some places where we're working, in Brazil particularly, it's been very difficult for them to relate to the church or a particular denomination. And they have to begin trying to relate to other Christians. But you need other Christians. Other Christians help you develop in ways that you probably don't realize. But it's similar to a person being raised in a family and a person who is raised in an orphanage. If all you have known throughout your Christian life is the Navigators, I think you're handicapped. As much as I love the Navigators, as much as they benefit you, you're handicapped if that's all you know. It's just like being raised in an orphanage with other guys or girls your own age. There's just something missing if you haven't been around old people. There's something missing if you haven't been around little kids. Being in that sort of a family atmosphere develops you, not in a specific way that you can look back and say, now I learned this and I learned that, but just in your personality and your character. Tony. 5 minutes, thank you. How do you do it in 5 minutes? Thank you. So it's not for PR, but what those other Christians can do for you. You know, when I have a younger brother. If I had not had my younger brother, I would, I think, be even more pompous than I am. Because my little brother didn't let me get away with anything. He made fun of me. And I feel that through having a little brother who didn't take me very seriously, I got a lot of corners knocked off. My dad was always on to me about things. He nagged me. I feel that that taught me some things and developed some things in me. If you see, we say in the Navigators, don't get involved with the half-hearted. And you know, if you're only involved with wholehearted people all the time, you're going to lack something. How else are you going to learn patience, compassion? Have you ever had to work with a person who is handicapped somehow physically? Or do you just work with all the people who are, you know, 100%? Then I think there's something missing. And through being involved with a group of other Christians, I feel we learn these things. Now let me mention something for those of you who are thinking about going into a church. Or you will, not thinking about it. You'll be part of a church somewhere. What will happen, the Navigators have taught you five things, let's say. You've learned five things from the Navigators, and those things are really going to help that church. Those things are necessary. Personal evangelism, individual follow-up, practical Bible study, and a couple of other things we could name. Those things are really going to be helpful in that church. But you know what you're going to do? You're going to go into that church, and you've got these five things, and you're going to run into people. You're going to irritate people. You're going to push them the wrong way. You're going to upset them. Because you've got your little five things right here. And when the pastor isn't memorizing scripture by putting his verses on cards, you're going to just think, well, there's something wrong. Well, now, those five things are important. But you've got to keep them in perspective. Keep them, because that church can teach you 20 things. There are 20 things that that group of Christians can teach you, can build into your life. Your five things are going to be vital for that church. But you get them in perspective. Let the church begin, these other Christians begin to build these things into your life. And you know what you'll find? You'll be able to build them in. But if you go into that church with these five things up here, you're going to be frustrated because you won't be able to pass those things along. So maybe that relates a little bit to your question. So we won't take too much time on that one now because I want to finish these and then just give you another minute for questions. Second or seventh guideline, if a person is married that we're working with in the community ministry, we'll work with them as a couple. If they're married, we'll work with them as a couple, rather than separating them and getting the man involved in this ministry and the woman involved in this ministry. No, let's, as far as possible, work with them as a couple. I won't say too much more about that.
Do you mean couples ministering or ministering to couples?
Ministering to them as a couple?
Right.
And in, yes. Or if you're just a single man, that if you're working with the husband, training him, try to get the wife in on it as well. Don't feel, well, I've got to get him off in a corner and teach him these great spiritual truths that his wife can't quite take. That's the quickest way to ruin your ministry with the guy and to ruin the marriage. I've done that, so I'm standing here as a guy who says that's not the way to do it, because I did it. And by the grace of God, the marriage was saved in the end, even though I was ignorant. So work with them as a couple. My final point is, it's open season on people. It's open season on people. Anybody can become a disciple and a disciple maker. You don't have to look to ask for his military ID card or his student registration card. Anybody can become a disciple or a disciple maker. Matthew 9:35-38. The harvest is great, the laborers are few. Pray therefore the Lord of the harvest. And when I talk about laborers, pray that the Lord of the harvest will send forth laborers. When I'm talking about laborers, I'm not talking about full-timers. I'm talking about plumbers and teachers and engineers. And of course, that's why that first question I feel is so important, that you can serve God on your job and be involved in disciple making. It's open season on people. There are over 50 cities, and Tony, could you pass out that map? Now, just the map. There are over 50 cities in the United States that have populations more than 300,000. There are more than 50 cities, 50, that have populations of 300,000 or more. And the Navigators have community ministry workers working full-time in 15 of them. And that's what we've got marked on the map. So I hand that map out for two things. When you think about leaving the military or leaving the college ministry, if nobody says to you, hey, why don't you get a job near this base and help us with the ministry? Or get a job near this college and help us reach college students. If nobody says that to you, then I would suggest you think about getting a job somewhere near where one of these X's or these dots are. Because there's where there are guys who really want to see disciple making going on in the community. But you know, there are 50 cities, over 300,000, and we're only in 15 of them. So we're hoping to spread this network and more have fellows who can stimulate and encourage you as you get out into the community to carry on the ministry of disciple making. Now, to really help you, let's pass out the addresses of these places, the names and addresses, and it'll give a little idea of where the people are and what kind of ministry there is. Okay, can we close now? We're over time. So let's just, while they're passing those out, are there any questions or further comments about the community ministry? Yes, sir.
When you mentioned you need someone around to keep the vision, are you thinking about a person just going out on their own? Or were you just thinking about a person who's in an area where there is an AF ministry, but just not being, not getting regular man-to-man?
Restate your question for me, would you please?
When you mentioned about that when we go out into a community ministry, that we need someone to stimulate us to keep the vision, to keep making disciples, this type thing. When you said that, were you thinking about a person going out on their own where they wouldn't have much contact with an AV rep or someone? Is that what you were thinking?
I'm suggesting that when you go out on your own into the business world, into your profession, that you need to be around someone within 100 miles or 200 miles where you can be stimulated and encouraged and reminded. I think that's maybe the word, reminded. Where's your man? See, oh, boy, I forgot that. You know, I've had 300 guys in Bible study, and we've had 400 rallies, and, you know, really had great things going on, but there aren't any disciples. Oh, boy, I just need to be reminded of that, that the name of the game is disciples and disciple makers. So, you know, try to realize that you can't do it on your own. You need someone to be at least a reminder. And maybe you can do it by correspondence. But usually you need someone around. And even disciple making, you see, I don't think you can just go and do it by yourself. Because the men you are building in then are going to be just like you, and that would be a catastrophe. They need to be like, you know, the whole body. They need to have other Christians building in their lives as well as you. Okay, our time is up. Thank you very much. Let's close with prayer, shall we? Father, drive home to us the things that are from you, and may we please forget those things that are of the flesh, and would you be the one who teaches us and helps us, Father, to make a difference in the places where you place us. We do long to be light in dark places, and we long to be salt. So we do this, Father, only if you will work through us. In Jesus' name, amen.